Crime Wave 49, J.P. O'Donnell, Fatal Gamble.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
C-R-I-M-E-W-A-V. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
You are listening to Episode 1 of Fatal Gamble, a novel written and narrated by J.P. O'Donnell.
Chapter 1. At 6:30 in the morning, Dr. Jonathan Becker reached over and turned off the alarm clock for the last time in his life. He got up and then, on an impulse, bent over and kissed his wife Suzanne, who was still sleeping. He quietly closed the bedroom door and walked down the winding staircase to the foyer of their country French home. He disarmed the alarm system by entering the 4-digit security code into the keypad at the side entry to the house. He stepped out and picked up the morning edition of the Boston Globe from the driveway. It was a beautiful October morning in New England. He sat down at the kitchen table for his favorite breakfast combination, the newspaper and a bowl of triple berry Cheerios. He left the house at 7:30, in plenty of time to make it to his office in Westcastle for his first patient at 8:30. To avoid the traffic on Routes 3 and 95, he always drove on the back roads to Westcastle and listened to the sports radio station WEEI. Between 7:40 and 8 o'clock, the two co-hosts did a segment called Headlines, in which they satirized and spoofed the leading stories of the day or discussed some wacky news item. It was funny and irreverent, a great way to enjoy the ride. Dr. Becker reached Westcastle after the usual 20-minute drive and turned into the large parking lot of his medical building. Looking at the 6-story, multi-shaded brick building in the morning sunshine, surrounded by its manicured landscaping, always gave him a warm sense of satisfaction. He was part of the 6-man partnership that bought the land, designed, and built the Parker Hill Medical Building, which was the foundation of his financial assets and the place where he had established one of the most successful pediatric practices in Massachusetts. He drove to the rear of the parking lot. Headlines was almost over, so he sat in his Lexus with the motor running to listen to the final portion of the show while he looked over his appointment book for the week. A black vehicle pulled into the space immediately to his left. The front passenger window rolled down. An arm extended out of the window. The motion caught Dr. Becker's attention, and he slowly turned his head toward the black car. What's happening here? A .357 Magnum revolver, equipped with a silencer at the end of the barrel, was pointed directly at him. My God, not like this. Before he could react, the glass window of his car shattered with a loud pop. A powerful force struck his neck and lower jaw, driving him violently to his right. His body recoiled. Now almost upright, he offered an easy target for the second bullet that screamed through his head. Blood, brain matter, and particles of bone splattered all over the interior of the car. The black car slowly backed out of its space and drove away. Dr. Jonathan Becker slumped forward. His body gradually listed to the right of the steering wheel. The motor of his car kept running. It was 8 o'clock. Headlines was over. Chapter 2. Corinne Albrecht always parked her car in the rear of the parking lot, so she could admire the flower beds as she walked toward the building. Today, the hardy mums and marigolds were gorgeous, and she was totally focused on them until she felt the crunch of glass under her shoes. Looking down, her eyes followed the tinted glass trail toward Dr. Becker's car, then up to the blown-out window. As she leaned toward the car, the sight of a man slouched over the front seat horrified her. Blood was everywhere. She screamed, feeling as if her knees were buckling under her. With tears streaming down her face, she reached for her cell phone. Her hands shook so badly, it took three tries to dial 911. Westcastle Police, is this an emergency?
Yes, someone's been shot. I think he's dead. I saw him, she yelled.
Try to calm down, ma'am. Can you tell me your name and your location?
My name?
Yes, tell me your name and where you're located. She looked back toward the medical building as if she had never seen the place before. Finally, she answered, Parker Hill Medical Building.
Okay, ma'am. Help is on the way. Stay on the line with me. Can you tell me your name and a little bit more about what you saw?
Corinne Albrecht was unable to respond. She put her cell phone in her bag and backed away from the gruesome scene, feeling weak and nauseous. She buried her face in her hands and leaned against the parked car to keep herself from falling. The EMTs arrived within a few minutes. Three uniformed men emerged from the ambulance and recognized Dr. Becker almost immediately, despite the gaping wounds in his head and neck. They went through the motions of examining him, but they knew in only a few seconds that nothing could be done to revive him. One of the men spread a light blanket over Corinne, who was shivering in the morning air. She's in shock, he said, as he offered her a bottle of water and encouraged her to lie down in the ambulance.
No, I'm okay, she murmured, as she sat down on a low stone wall.
They removed Dr. Becker from his car, placed him on a stretcher, and then loaded him into the ambulance. Cries of shock and anguish spread throughout the small crowd of onlookers that had gathered a short distance from the car. Most were employees in the building. Others were patients who had arrived for their appointments. They stood in disbelief as the emergency vehicle, with its sirens blaring, sped away to Westcastle Hospital, carrying the pediatrician who had been loved and respected by the entire community. Several police cruisers entered from the south entrance to the parking lot. The flashing red and blue lights reflected off the glass windows of the building, creating an eerily electric mood at the scene of deadly violence. The police moved quickly and used yellow crime scene tape to cordon off the rear section of the parking lot, including Dr. Becker's car. Even the police officers seemed unnerved by the entire situation. After all, Westcastle, assassinations just didn't happen in this town. Detective Jack Hoskins pulled up in a dark blue, unmarked car and left it parked diagonally with the front door open. As he got out of his car, all of the police actions seemed to stop and focus on him. The police officers deferred to him as he peered into Dr. Becker's car and started asking questions. Hoskins, a burly, barrel-chested man, was no stranger to murder scenes. He had been a Boston cop and police detective for more than 30 years before taking the job in Westcastle, a place with little stimulation for someone used to solving big-city crimes. But now, in just his second year on this road-to-retirement job, he felt a familiar rush of excitement as he looked at a scene that bore all the markings of an underworld hit job.
"What have we got here?" asked Hoskins, his eyes riveted on the bloody interior of the car.
"No one heard or saw anything, Jack," said one of the officers.
"Where's the woman who made the call? Did she see anything?"
"She's sitting over there.
"The one wearing a blue sweater with a blanket around her," said the other officer, a young guy who looked like he had just graduated from high school, let alone the police academy. Hoskins made his way over to Corinne.
"Excuse me, ma'am. Detective Jack Hoskins, Westcastle Police Department. I know you're upset, but I need to ask you a few questions."
Corinne looked up at him. Tears streamed down her face.
"Did you see anyone near the car or driving away when you came in today?"
"No," she said softly. The response hardly left her mouth when Hoskins barked,
"Did you see a car leaving the entrance to the lot when you came in?"
"No. It was pretty quiet when I got here," said Corinne, trying to cope with the rapid-fire sequence of questions from her intimidating inquisitor.
"Did you hear any loud noises, popping sounds, tire screeching, anything unusual?"
"No, nothing until I saw the broken window in that car," she replied with a shrug, but still shaking from her jarring discovery a few minutes earlier. Hoskins recognized that she had nothing to offer and brusquely turned away, barely acknowledging her willingness to help. He walked back to the victim's car and studied it intently. He looked past the gore. Instead, he tried to visualize the path the bullets must have taken as they smashed through the glass, penetrated the victim's head and neck, and then passed into the leather fabric of the passenger door. The size of the holes and their location near the door handle indicated a large caliber weapon fired in a downward direction. Hoskins, unfazed by the color of blood all around him, studied the floor mats and seat cushions, looking for possible clues or bullet fragments. The murder scene did not repel him. It made him salivate. Hoskins called over to the two police officers who were taking notes from people in the crowd. "I want every employee in the building interviewed. Find out what they heard, what they saw. Anything unusual that happened here in the past few weeks. Did they see any strangers hanging around? Talk to all of Becker's employees, especially those who took his phone calls and messages. Did he owe anyone a lot of money? Any patient or family who had a problem with him? Was he running around on his wife? Ask if he got any threatening phone calls." The officers nodded, scribbling his orders on their notepads as they tried to keep up with his rant. Hoskins flashed a look of disdain. "They better not forget anything or I'll make them regret it." Hoskins slowly got into his car, using his left hand on the edge of the roof for support as he settled into his seat. His eyes winced, a sign that his back problems had become more than just a minor annoyance. He drove out of the parking lot and turned right toward Westcastle Hospital, where he hoped to see Dr. Becker's wife. By this time, someone must have called her about her husband's murder. Hoskins wanted to be one of the first to judge her reaction to the news. This crime was either the random act of some nutjob or the work of a professional hitman. In these cases, you always look at the spouse first.
Chapter 3. A woman sat on a bench in the waiting area of the emergency room at Westcastle Hospital, with her head down, sobbing uncontrollably. She had short, silver-gray hair and wore a black leather waist-length jacket and black pants. Her face was pale and drawn, no makeup. It appeared that she had just thrown herself together before getting to the hospital. Another woman, looking shocked herself, had one arm around her shoulders, trying to offer comfort while simultaneously looking all around the room as if searching for help. Hoskins approached the women. "Excuse me, are you Mrs. Becker?" The woman with the gray hair slowly looked up. She could barely speak, but said, "Yes, I am." J.
Jack Hoskins, West Castle PD, he said, holding out his badge to verify his identity. I know this is an extremely difficult time for you, Mrs. Becker. I'm sorry about your husband, but could you answer a few questions for me? Yes, I'll try, she replied, dabbing at her eyes with a tissue. Do you have any idea who could have done this to Dr. Becker? No, I still can't believe it, she said, her voice trembling. Did he give you any signs of trouble or that anyone was causing him problems? No, nothing unusual. He never said a word about any problems. I would have known, she said, as her voice cracked with emotion and her head leaned into the shoulder of the other woman. She began crying again. Hoskins crouched down toward her and took her quivering hands into his. This was not easy for Hoskins, a man who could never be accused of having a soft touch. Mrs. Becker, he said, with a reassuring voice, I want you to know that we will do everything possible to find out who did this. His words were full of conviction, not just a casual promise, but a vow that he would devote all his time and energy to solving this crime. Hoskins nodded to both women and said, If you'll excuse me, ladies. He trailed off without finishing and walked over to the registration desk of the emergency room. He asked the charge nurse if he could speak to the doctor on duty. She pushed a button at her desk that opened a set of automatic doors, allowing Hoskins to enter the main area of the emergency room. A few minutes later, another set of automatic doors opened, and a young man emerged, wearing hospital scrubs and a surgeon's cap that was off-center and tied loosely around his head. I'm Dr. Kendrick. How can I help you? The young man asked, with his hands on his hips, quizzically eyeing the person who was looking for him. Jack Hoskins, West Castle PD. Just want to make sure that nothing is disturbed until the medical examiner performs the autopsy. No problem. We've already contacted the ME's office. They'll be doing the post within the next 2 hours. What was the time? He was DOA at 8:25 a.m., said the doctor, with a matter-of-fact tone. A few seconds passed. Hoskins did not respond. Kendrick's shoulders sagged as he seemed to relax into an off-the-record demeanor. We haven't had a murder victim brought into this hospital in more than 10 years, he sighed. And then today, it happens to be one of the doctors on the staff. How do you figure that? He asked as he gestured with his palms up and his hands held apart. He hesitated for a second as his question hung in the air, looked around to the rear door of the ER, and then turned back to Hoskins. This is really a tough one, he said. I knew Jonathan Becker very well. Yeah, this is tough for all of us, Doc, said Hoskins coldly, as he turned and walked out to the waiting area. He paused for a brief moment and stared across the room towards the two women. Suzanne Becker continued to sit on the bench. The other woman held her a little more tightly and talked to her quietly. Hoskins just nodded as he walked by. He had already eliminated Suzanne Becker as a suspect in his book. He had held her hands and seen the pain and total devastation in her face. As a veteran of dozens of murder investigations, he had learned to read people, to look into their eyes and know when they were faking, trying to throw the police off track. He knew Mrs. Becker's reactions were genuine and that she had nothing to do with her husband's murder. Hoskins had just one problem. Until the ballistics tests came back, he didn't have a single clue to tell him where to begin. Chapter 4 Daniel Cormac Gallagher Jr. rolled over in bed, opened one eye, and looked at his clock radio. 8:45 in the morning. He had planned to get up by 7:30, but just couldn't get his body moving. Definitely not a morning person. He had pressed the snooze button 5 times before finally turning the clock off sometime after 8 o'clock. When he eventually did get out of bed, he always needed a few cups of coffee and a long shower to get his molecules mobilized. Then, usually by about 10:30 or 11, he was up to full steam. But lazy mornings suited him just fine. As a private investigator, the scoundrels he secretly followed didn't cause too much mischief in the mornings, and the people he interviewed never seemed to be available until later in the day. He finally got into the bathroom and looked at himself in the mirror. "Oh, you look pretty scary today," he said, bending over the sink and splashing some cool water on his face and stubbly beard. His black hair was infiltrated with ever-increasing amounts of gray at the temples and the crown. "Is that what they call distinguished? Well, at least I've still got a full head of hair." His hair was trimmed short, hardly requiring a comb to make it look presentable. He reached for his toothbrush and applied a generous amount of toothpaste. Brushing and flossing his teeth were a true compulsion. No cavities or gum disease for this guy. His teeth were perfect, and he worked at keeping them that way. At age 45, Gallagher had reached a certain level of peace and comfort with his life. He had recovered emotionally from his divorce and the painful circumstances that caused him to leave the Boston police. He had started his business as a private investigator 7 years ago. By now, his reputation had spread so well that each new case that came through the door seemed to bring 2 others. A dogged investigator, he had a clever but natural way of getting information out of people. Strangers felt comfortable around Gallagher and were willing to talk to him. Somehow people would actually tell him things that they might not tell to the police. Whether it was the front desk clerk at a motel or a hooker on the street, Gallagher could convince them to provide the facts he needed to help solve a case. Most of his cases had a similar theme, looking for a missing teenager who had left the suburbs for the wild life of the city, trying to locate a deadbeat father, tracking the escapades of a cheating husband, or running background checks for suspicious fathers whose daughters were intent on marrying a gold digger. No matter what the assignment, he had an amazing record of success and generally produced the results his clients wanted. In some ways, however, this success merely underscored a flaw that he actually recognized in himself. He simply couldn't let go. Gallagher was relentless. He had to follow a job through to its end, never accepting defeat or letting circumstances get the best of him. He would become consumed with a case, the details of which would stay with him morning, noon, and night, as he dissected the evidence until he came up with an answer that tied everything together into one neat, plausible package. This singular, unwavering approach had been a problem for him as a police officer, and eventually led to an impasse with his supervisors, who felt that he refused to follow departmental orders and protocol. He still bristled at the unfair accusations that had been leveled against him. He had to admit, when he left the police force, most of his superiors had been glad to see him go. This left a blemish on his record, but more importantly, a scar on his psyche. Except for his personal secretary, Diane, no one ever called him anything but Gallagher. As far back as he could remember, That was his name to his friends, teachers, teammates, even his first wife, and now Kate, the latest woman in his life. In fact, his business card simply read, Gallagher, Private Investigator. This fit perfectly with the way he conducted himself. Nothing fancy, get to the point, no wasted words, just Gallagher. He turned the knob in the shower counterclockwise to the 3 o'clock position to let the water warm up. While he waited, he pushed the message button on his answering machine and listened as Diane gave him his heads up for the day. Good morning, Dan. Just wanted to remind you that this is the night Mr. Cunningham has a late meeting at the office and then has to drive down to Hartford for an all-day conference tomorrow. I'll be in the office. Call me if you need anything. Thank God for Diane. Without her, I wouldn't know where to go every day. Mr. Cunningham's wife was one of Gallagher's newest clients and had come into his office a few weeks ago with suspicions that her husband was having an affair. She was convinced that he used his late meetings and days out of town as cover-ups for romps with his latest mistress. Mrs. Cunningham had reached her limit, and she was ready to take the old boy for everything he was worth. It was the same story that Gallagher had heard dozens of times before, but really one of the easiest mysteries to solve. He had told her to keep him informed of the next late meeting. Tonight was the night. He stepped into the shower and ducked his head under the invigorating, pulsating stream of hot water. I hope Mr. Cunningham has a good time tonight. This is going to be the most expensive piece of ass he's ever had. Chapter 5. Dr. Richard Evans stepped out of his forest green Dodge Ram truck and walked across the upper level of the parking lot and then down the sloping asphalt toward the ground floor entrance of the Parker Hill Medical Building. It had been 3 weeks since the murder of his friend and real estate partner, Dr. Jonathan Becker. Still, the shock had not worn off. The Westcastle police had questioned virtually every employee in the building and interviewed all the neighbors, but had yet to come up with one witness and neither a suspect nor a motive. As he walked toward the building on this quiet Tuesday morning, Dick Evans considered his own theory. Some lunatic with a vendetta against the medical profession. Who else could it be? And just Jonathan's luck to run into him. At 6:20 in the morning, it was still dark, as daylight saving time had a few more days to run before the clocks would be adjusted on the weekend. Dr. Evans, an internist who had practiced in Westcastle for more than 30 years, was one of the first to arrive at the building. He liked to sit in his office with a cup of coffee or catch up on some dictation before his first patient arrived. He was one of the 6 partners who had built the building, sold most of the units as office condominiums, and now shared ownership in more than 20,000 square feet of rented medical space. With Jonathan Becker's death, the responsibility for putting together the documents necessary for the remaining partners to buy Becker's share of the partnership from his estate had fallen on Dick Evans' shoulders. It was a painful process, not just a result of the paperwork involved, but mostly because of the constant and eerie reminder of the words, in the event of a partner's death. When they drew up the buyout agreements, Dick never expected that Jonathan, the youngest member of the group, would be the first to die. Dr. Evans entered the building and walked into the atrium, past the Japanese flower garden in the outer lobby. He usually walked up the stairs to a second-floor office, but his knee had been giving him increasing trouble. He decided to take the elevator. He pressed the up arrow, and the elevator door opened immediately. As he got inside the elevator, he thought that it was good to take the elevator once in a while so he could check to see if the management company maintained it in proper condition. They had painted it a few years ago with a yellowish-brown color that was so atrocious that one of the doctors demanded that it be repainted. Now it was a soft shade of blue, and things appeared to be in pretty good repair. At the second floor, the door opened, and Dr. Evans stepped to the edge of the doorway. An imposing figure standing directly in front of him blocked his path. The person wore a Red Sox cap, a dark jacket, jeans, and a pair of running shoes. Dr. Evans started to move past this obstruction. Suddenly, a .357 Magnum revolver was pointed straight at him. Dr. Evans froze. Who is this? His thoughts flashed to his partner, Dr. Jonathan Becker. Oh my God, I'm going to die the same way. 5 shots were fired in rapid succession. The bullets struck his chest. The force sent him sprawling to the back of the elevator. Blood splattered all over the interior walls, floor, and ceiling. Dr. Evans' head and arms sagged toward the floor as the life in his muscles and bullet-riddled body quickly evaporated. Blood trickled down from his half-open mouth as a huge and widening red stain appeared on his shirt. The shooter calmly placed the gun into the right pocket of the jacket, turned to the left, walked quickly down the hallway, and then down the south stairwell. The shooter exited the building through the side entrance, then walked out to a lone car in the lower parking lot, just a few spaces from the door. Within seconds, the car had driven away. You have been listening to Fatal Gamble, a novel written and narrated by J.P. O'Donnell. Music by Brian Horowitz of Cheese Merge. For more information on the author and his books, please visit www.jpodonnell.com.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email, and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
Here's a song to the star, but the shape of a snake and a smile that went along with that.
Get trusted!